She hesitated, and then said, "Wait. In this large circle, this tiny feature here must be the holy temple, and this must be Bright's heaven. But everything is so distorted. The circle must be Egg itself, and these seven small dots must be Bright's eyes." She looked again at the Institute astrologer and said, "This is a picture of Egg and the eyes of Bright. But why is everything on Egg so distorted? It looks like it has been stretched in the east-west direction."
"We don't know," said the Institute astrologer. "We are still trying to figure that out. We have since received another picture map, and the present signals are in the process of beaming down a third one."
"May I feel them?" Swiftkiller asked. The Institute astrologer pulled out two more tally strings from carrying pouches and laid them out on the crust without comment. They were close enough together so that Swiftkiller could spread herself out to cover both of them at the same time.
"This shows the eyes of Bright," Swiftkiller said. "But the smaller inner eye is not just a featureless circle like the others. It has strange markings and circles on it, and there is a cylinder sticking out of one side. And this other is an enlargement of the inner eye, and you can see forms inside the circle, as if you were peering through holes in the inner eye."
Swiftkiller paused.
"What does all this mean?" she asked.
"We are not positive," said the Institute astrologer, "but we think that those things we can see inside the orifices are strange beings."
"But they are so stick-like and angular. They would be broken in a moment," she exclaimed.
"They are floating in the sky above the East Pole, so they seem to be immune to the gravity pull of Egg, although why they want such long manipulator bones is unknown."
While the Institute astrologer had been talking, Swiftkiller had been re-examining the pictures.
"The inner eye looks like a giant machine," she said. "This thing at the top of the cylinder looks like a glancer in a holder, and these other things look like my expander."
"What is an expander?" asked the astrologer.
Swiftkiller finally remembered that she had not yet told him of her discovery. She had come to give him some new knowledge, but instead had been bedazzled with one new concept after another. Swiftkiller formed a manipulator, reached into a carrying pouch, and pulled out the expander and the shrinker. Then she explained their odd behavior to the Institute astrologer as he moved them back and forth in front of one of his eyes.
"This curved shape for a glancer means that it can send a beam of light a long way," she told him. "And that is probably why they exist on the inner eye thing, to send the beams down to us on Egg."
The Institute astrologer moved on to the tally pictures on the crust and compared the shapes of the things protruding from the inner eye with the object that he held.
"The shapes are very similar," he said. "You are probably right. But what is this about sending beams?"
"I came to give you a demonstration," Swiftkiller said.
"Wait,"
the Institute astrologer suggested. "I will gather the rest of the members of the Institute." Soon, Swiftkiller was the center of attention as she demonstrated her bright light source and the way the expander could bring the light into a hot spot or send it off in a straight beam. After several demonstrations, Swiftkiller let some of the more eager novices play with the new toy. As she flowed back to talk to the Institute astrologer, she could hear others starting to grind away at two plates to make their own expanders. It was soon obvious to all in the Institute that Swiftkiller's new invention provided a means to signal back to whatever it was in the inner eye that was beaming down messages to them. After several turns, they set up a bright light source and started sending off a coded message aimed at the eyes of Bright. They kept it up for many turns, but nothing happened. The pulsed beam from the inner eye continued its methodical blinking, slowly finishing off the last picture. After many, many turns, Swiftkiller had a thought. Far to the east of Bright's Heaven was a fracture ridge that stuck up just over the horizon. Its side was the quarry for the blocks that were used to build the housing and storage compounds for Bright's Heaven. Swiftkiller decided to go out to the quarry and make the arduous climb up the slope to the top. Then she would look for the beam of light that the astrologers would send periodically in that direction. After a dozen turns, a dejected Swiftkiller returned to the Institute. "It is no wonder that Inner Eye is not responding to our signals," she said. "I can just barely see them from the top of the quarry." "I was afraid of that," the Institute astrologer said. "The eyes are so low on the horizon that our light beam has to travel a long way through the absorbing atmosphere. It is too bad that the eyes of Bright are hovering over the East Pole. If it were hovering above us, we could not only detect their beam easier, but they could see our pitifully weak attempt at a response." Swiftkiller shivered at the thought of something hanging over her in the sky, but agreed that Bright had certainly sent his seven eyes to the poorest spot in the sky for seeing. Then, suddenly, Swiftkiller had an idea. "If we went to the East Pole, we could send our light beams straight up to the inner eye. The distance through the atmosphere would be a lot shorter, and the beam would be going in the easy direction, and would not fade so much." "But nobody goes to the East Pole," the Institute astrologer protested. "The land is full of barbarians. Every direction that you move is in the hard direction. The sky is hot and full of volcano smoke. The crust is too bristly to move on. No Chela could survive there." "I know it's not as nice as Bright's Heaven," Swiftkiller said, "but Chela can survive there. After all, as you said, the place is infested with barbarians." "Actually," Swiftkiller went on, "the troopers on the eastern border have penetrated a good way toward the East Pole in punitive raids on barbarian settlements. We have them cowed enough that they would not bother a good-sized expedition." A discussion of the pros and cons of Swiftkiller's suggestion continued for many turns. The cost would be high, especially in terms of the number of troopers that would be needed to guard an expedition deep into barbarian territory. It was beyond the resources and authority of the Inner Eye Institute, and the idea might have been dropped if the last section of the third picture had not been so dramatic. The picture of the machine with the strange beings was remarkable enough, for there was no doubt that the stick-like things seen vaguely through the holes in the inner eye were beings. But up in one corner of the picture was a familiar figure placed next to the familiar, although stretched, outlines of the holy temple. It seemed incredulous, but the markings left no doubt that the being was about 1/12 as big as the temple. When the new picture was completed, the Institute astrologer decided that he had better inform the rest of the ruling authorities of their discoveries. Initially, the high priest and the chief astrologer were perturbed about the Institute astrologer's interpretation of the pictures, but finally accepted his version as no threat to their religion by assuming that Bright worked in a mysterious way and that sometime in the distant future it would all become clear to them. The leader of the combined clans, although nominally a devout worshipper of the god Bright, was willing to compartmentalize her mind and look at the pictures without being bothered by the religious overtones.
"Weird-looking creatures," the leader said, "and giants at that. Yet if they have learned to hover in the sky without falling down, we could learn much from them, and they seem to be willing to talk to us. It can't hurt to learn more. Proceed with the expedition."
There was no doubt in anyone's mind who would be the leader of the expedition. As a combined astrologer, thinker, and battle commander, Swiftkiller was the obvious choice. With the authority of the leader of the combined clans behind her, Swiftkiller organized the expedition. They would be gone for many, many turns. And meanwhile, the work of the Institute had to go on. So she only took a few of the younger astrologers and novices. A good supply of flares and concentrated pod juice were obtained under her direction. And during that time, a few excellent large-diameter expanders had been manufactured by the careful grinding of newly trained artisans. One of the expanders was so large in diameter that only a few of the novices could get a carrying pouch around it. Once it was pouched, they could carry little else. For the trip out to the eastern border, no troopers were needed for protection, and the food stops sufficed for supplies. However, messengers were sent ahead to gather the supplies that the expedition would need in the turns ahead. Soon, Swiftkiller returned to take over command of her troop of needle troopers, for naturally she had requested that they supply the guard for the expedition. Soon, the entire party was assembled. Rations were distributed, and civilians were taught the elementary thrusts of the short sword in case a barbarian ever penetrated to the center of the circle formation. Finally, they left, gliding easily over the crust toward the east magnetic pole. Time, 7:56 and 29 seconds, GMT. Monday, 20 June, 2050. Dead troopers pulled her eye down from its crystallium cord stub and pushed her way off in the hard direction, keeping her body as thin as sex until she was well over the horizon. She could not figure out why this circle of troopers were penetrating so far into her territory. The scouts had reported that they were on the move, and she had acted to defend the nearest village that would have been an obvious target for a punitive attack. But the circle of troopers had carefully worked its way around it. Such behavior of Empire troopers was new, and dead troopers hated anything new. They were up to something, and she would stop it. But what? As she slithered into the compound, she noticed with glum satisfaction that the scrape of her tread on the crust had warned the camp. Those who were presently in her good graces were merely very busy taking care of important matters, while those who weren't had rapidly absented themselves when they felt the first murmurs of her approach. Her second in command, and one of her lovers, was busy rubbing his unusually brilliant short sword against a chunk of crust. Although the cast dragon crystal would usually stay sharp until the edge was notched by a hard blow, it did help a little to keep the edge in fine hone by monotonous rubbing against the crustal material. Dead troopers knew that Pink Sky had never let the short sword get dull since the time he had wrested it from the dead body of a trooper whom they had killed jointly. She glided up next to Pink Sky until their edges were touching along almost half their length. Pink Sky continued to hone his sword as dead troopers watched.
"They are in full force," she said, "but they do not attack. I don't like it."
"There are very few things about troopers that you do like," he replied calmly. Dead troopers paused for a moment, then said,
"Well, I like this even less."
"Where are they going?" Pink Sky asked. Dead troopers shifted, several eyes staring at Pink Sky, while the rest wriggled in irritation.
"It looks as if they are headed for the East Pole," she said. "But that makes no sense at all. No one goes to the East Pole. It is too hot and bristly."
Pink Eye remarked sagely, "They seem to be getting very far from their home base, and the mountainous territory near the East Pole makes the horizons undependable." Dead troopers paused a moment, and then realized what her second in command was referring to. It was a good thing he was a lot smaller than she was, or he would have been leader of the clan.
"You are right, as usual," she said. "Let us gather the warriors and go east to the first range of ridges, to the one that has a cliff different than the rest, the one that looks as if it is a horizon until you are almost on it."
Pink Sky shortly had a signaling crew together and was sending out phased messages to the nearby barbarian clan settlements. The message took a long time to send, since the signaling crew had to adjust their treading to emphasize the natural resonant frequencies of the crust.
"What is that strange rumbling sound in the crust?"
one of the novices inside the circle of marching troopers asked.
"Is it a crust quake?"
"No,"
another said.
"This is the wrong part of egg for quakes."
Swiftkiller had felt the rumble long before the novices. Despite what one of them had said, the East Pole was crust-quake country. But this was not a quake. What they felt was only a long-distance signal from one barbarian clan to another. From its similarities to others she had heard, it was probably the call to assemble. No doubt her expedition this deep in barbarian territory had caused some concern. Since it was a long-distance message, and not a localized call for attack, she had no need to put the troopers on alert. But she noticed with pride that most of them had felt the presence of the barbarians, and that the dragon teeth, which had been in typical marching disarray, now gleamed as a single, coordinated, double row of interleaved needles. At the next rest break, Swiftkiller ordered out the feeding time perimeter guard and gathered the civilians to the center.
"The barbarians have called for an assembly to decide what to do about us," she said. "Hopefully they will realize that we are not bothering their settlements and are too large to attack and will leave us alone. However, this is the territory of Trooper Killer, one of the few barbarian chieftains to have killed more than one trooper and survived to tell about it. For the next few turns, we will keep in a tight circle formation, and you civilians will have to stay in the center."
Moving in one direction, while looking and fighting in another direction, came easily to the multi-eyed, non-oriented Sheila. Although each had a preferred set of eyes, all dozen worked well and gave the Sheila a complete, if two-dimensional, view of the region around them. Each Sheila also had one or two preferred eating pouches and elimination orifices, but with a little concentration to break many turns of habit, the two could actually be reversed in function if necessary. The same went for carrying pouches, which were just immature feeding pouches. However, it was only the very young or very old who slobbered on their collection of trinkets. On the body of a typical Sheila, there were certain sections of skin that had developed good muscle tone and a high level of tactile sensory endings that made the best pseudopods, and there were other chunky muscular sections that were the best to drape about a crystallium manipulator skeleton for maximum leverage. All troopers learned in basic training camp to form deep pockets in their skin, backed up with crystallium sockets embedded in their tread muscles to handle the long, heavy dragon teeth. A well-trained trooper could perform that function at any point around the circle, while maintaining the measured tread of the advance ripple, and simultaneously eating, eliminating, and switching trinkets from one pouch to the next. It was the brag of Swiftkiller's troopers that they could engage in sex on top of all of that. But as had been proved during a few after-battle orgies, that was more talk than performance. The commander of a circle of troopers had two choices. One was to put all the troopers of one sex in one ring, with the next ring of the opposite sex constantly riding partially on the top side of the first rank. This kept the troopers happy, with a constant reminder of fun, either under tread or topside. However, there was always the problem of the one or two who didn't quite fit into the geometry of the circle. A second choice was to alternate male and female side by side in each rank, with purely, nearly, platonic interaction between ranks, although they were overlapping on topsides. Swiftkiller preferred the second ordering, since it made for tighter rank spacing, despite the other problems it caused. At one time, early in her career as an officer, she had considered the possibility of a trooper circle made up of only one sex. She could see herself leading the ferocious females to triumph in battle. But her trooper background vetoed that bleak, joyless scene quickly. In their battles against the barbarians, the real enemy was boredom, and the single-sex battle circle would not survive long. Dead troopers led her clan and the out-family warriors who had joined them off to the east, then back again to the west.
"A long crawl for no progress,"
Sinking Cliff, one of the out-family fighters, complained. But even he had to admit that their route had taken them safely around the trooper scouts, who would slither quickly over the horizon and back again. Sinking Cliff had been the leader of his small clan before he had decided to join forces with Dead Trooper's larger clan that contained many of his out-family. The penetration of the large force of well-armed troopers into his clan territory was of great concern, and he readily joined himself and his three best warriors to the cause. However, he did not really like taking commands from someone else. Dead Troopers knew that she was treading on prickly crust when she heard the complaint and made her move, but she could tolerate no insubordination if she were going to keep control of this half-wild band.
"Silence!"
came Dead Trooper's harsh whisper, and Sinking Cliff half-raised his club as a dozen eyes on a huge form blazed down at him. Dead Troopers dropped into lingua interfamilia and applied her most diplomatic accent. Pink Sky would have been proud of her.
"Even hatchlings are quiet when the Swift is around,"
she admonished in a soft whisper.
"This dark side cliff we have come to is along the path of the marauding troopers,"
Dead Troopers continued.
"There is none other like it, since all other cliffs in this region show their faces to the bright light."
The tension relaxed, and Dead Troopers slid a pseudopod on the top side of Sinking Cliff as she continued.
"The path of the troopers takes them to the bright light side of this cliff. They will never see us behind it, and we can rush out and take them unaware."
She removed her pseudopod with a promising pat and glided off to arrange the attack. Time, 7:56 and 30 seconds, GMT. Monday, 20 June, 2050. The expedition to the East Pole moved slowly on in its quiet but determined way. Scouts moved ahead to look over the horizon, but the crust was getting prickly, especially on the way back, so they did not range out as far as they had done in the past. None of them realized that the horizon off to one side was not the real horizon, but instead was the top of a precipitous cliff that sheltered a horde of barbarians behind its sharp edge. It was to Dead Trooper's credit that she held her mixed pseudo-clan of warriors until the circle glided past. She released them with a terrible thump that shook the very crust under Swiftkiller's tread, and they attacked with a fury born of turn upon turn of punitive raids on their loved ones and hatchlings.
"At alert!"
trummed Swiftkiller, and narrowed herself down to pass through the dazed civilians to the rear of the circle. Her automatic judgment of the tactical situation was verified when she saw the stream of barbarians seem to pour endlessly out of a notch in the horizon. Her dozen eyes lifted slightly on Stubbs as they once again evaluated the near-perfect boundary between dark sky and glowing crust, and she saw her mistake. A slight rise of the glowing crust indicated a low cliff. Too low to see, but high enough to hide a war party of barbarians.
East, west, north, bright, east, west, north, bright, east,
chanted Swiftkiller, as her eyes took in the battle situation. Her troopers moved obediently in a rigid march that took them nowhere, as their bodies became attuned to the cooperative movement, and the deadly needles of the dragon teeth formed their impenetrable barrier about the circle of close-coupled troopers. The civilians peered over the flattened ranks of troopers, and some of them were beginning to panic. Swiftkiller lowered the intensity of her rhythmic thump on the crust as her squad leaders took up the chant to make up for the loss of her volume. Swiftkiller circled around the inner rank of her troopers, sliding encouraging pseudopods on male and female alike, as her whisper sped through the crust, its electronic tingle emphasizing the solid thump of the squad leaders.
North, bright, east, west, north.
At the same time, she thinned out the inner third of her body and spread a thin, hatching mantle over the bewildered non-combatants at the center. In almost automatic reflex action, their bodies reverted to minimum area, and they huddled together under the protective cloak. As the pressure in the center was released, the ranks of troopers compacted, and the needle points at the outer ring grew imperceptibly closer together. Swiftkiller watched the charge of the barbarians with cool detachment. Although they came in a group, they were still individuals, and the first of those individuals actually to make contact with the deadly circle of dragon teeth would die, and both she and the barbarians knew that horrible fact.
West, north, bright, east, west, north.
Swiftkiller added the thump of her tread to the clamor as the barbarians approached. With a roar that shook the very crust, they came straight along the easy direction from the west, then broke into two peeling waves that plowed their way off into the hard directions toward the north and bright sides. Swiftkiller had expected the attack to break off in the face of a well-tended circle. What she had not expected was the rattle of pod seeds and smooth rocks rolling and sliding across the crust toward her circle of troopers. That was all they were, rocks and garbage from an ordinary pod meal. But the unexpected did to her troopers what anything unexpected would do to any group. It confused them. In their effort to avoid what was harmless, the troopers slid to one side or the other. Their careful cadence was lost, and the impenetrable barrier of needle-like dragon teeth wavered. From the middle of the still-flowing barbarian horde burst dead troopers and five of her warriors. They were nearly hidden by their load of undried chela skin. Swiftkiller's eyes shrank at the sight, but she had to admire the tactical effectiveness of the result. As the raw chela skin contacted the pricks of the dragon teeth, the natural death reflexes in the muscular skin pouched up and grasped the points of the dragon teeth in vice-like sphincters. Backing off for a moment, the barbarians let the skins drag the ends of the deadly needles to the crust, and then flowed over their grisly weapon and pinned the circle defenses under their treads as they encountered the outer perimeter, their clubs and stolen short swords shattering crystal and slashing skin.
West, 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 west,
to trum Swiftkiller, as she changed the cadence and moved the circle into the direction of the attack. The small knot of fighting troopers and barbarians stayed fixed, each slashing where they could at the small amount of skin exposed behind their shields of dried skin or flow-slow plates. Meanwhile, the steady cadence moved the circle of troopers around the point of attack, like a cell enveloping its struggling prey. The surprise was gone, and the next rapid attack of the barbarians from the east did not produce the desired confusion when a rattle of crustal pebbles and pod seeds came sliding across the crust. The needle points of the dragon teeth did not waver, and the holders of the remainder of the poor, unfortunate Chila who had unwillingly donated his very skin to the cause of the barbarian attack, left their glowing white juices dripping off the ends of the dragon teeth.
"Out! Out! Out! Out!" Swiftkiller commanded.
She expanded the circle in all directions, but most importantly, in the direction towards the clump of barbarian warriors. The pincher closed, and the needle points of the dragon teeth began to have their effect. With the trap shut, Swiftkiller pulled back her mantle from over the civilians. Making herself into an avenging needle, she slipped her huge bulk between two of her troopers in the rear ranks. Three knives held in front of her, and her short sword trailing behind, she screeched a high-pitched whisper that threw the knot of combatants into confusion and dove in under their bodies, knives slashing. Swiftkiller climbed out of the hole she had carved out of the middle of dead trooper's body, glowing juices running down her eye stubs. She then attacked the rest of the beleaguered barbarians from behind. Their initiative was lost, and it took little time for the troopers to finish them all with thrusts of their short swords. Swiftkiller looked across the topsides of the still quivering bags of juice and surveyed her command. True to the tradition of trooper discipline, even if the commanders seemed to ignore it, the squad leaders had disengaged the little knot of dead and wounded to the inside, and a nearly perfect circle of regrouped troopers were now arrayed in rank after rank, their needle points in perfect array as the cadence continued.
East, west, north, bright, east, west, north.
The remainder of the barbarian horde sent taunts and curses through the crust, made weaker and weaker fainting attacks, and finally faded off over the horizon. Swiftkiller shivered her skin, sending yellow-white globs of cooling juice showering down on the bare topsides of the motionless layers of skin beneath her tread. She slowly flowed down off the sagging mound of flesh, checking each one of her short, slashing blades before inserting them back into her lined weapons pouch. As she descended, her tread automatically kneaded the flaccid skin beneath her, and worked out the lumps that were hidden away in the enemy skin pouches. One cache yielded buttons. Swiftkiller paused in shock. There were three single buttons that signaled that each had come from Trooper, a doublet button that used to grace the skin of a squad leader, and another with four buttons that matched the one that now glistened wetly on her supple skin.
"The trooper killer," she said,
and fury sent her short sword again and again through the already damaged brain knot. Her exhaustion forgotten in the discovery, she moved the dead hunks of meat off the sworn enemy of every troop commander of the east border, and proceeded to strip the tiniest pouch of that dead, hulking body. To her dismay, she found four more trooper buttons, well tarnished, in an almost sealed-off pouch, but nothing else.
"Kill, kill, kill," she murmured. "Nothing to live for but to kill troopers."
She went on to the other bodies, glancing around as she did so to notice that the battle was over and the circle was back in its proper form. One body yielded a trooper button, but this one came from the holding sphincter of a trooper, who had died defending its honor. She searched the periphery until she found the trooper's heritage pouch, and she slowly kneaded it until she extracted the mementos given to the trooper as he left his clan to join the Eastern Border Guard. She separated the personal ones from the clan ones, tossing most of the personal ones to the crust, but taking those that might be of value to her some turn. She put the clan totem into a special pouch that she sealed until she might, at some future time, deliver it to the clan chief, while giving thanks for the assistance of that segment of the clan in the protection of the far-flung borders of Bright's empire.
"It is a good thing that we lose so few troopers in these skirmishes with the barbarians," she thought to herself, "or else the troop commanders would be so laden down with clan totems that they would not be able to move."
At the thought, she self-consciously twitched the little pouch in a forgotten segment of her body that had not been opened for over 36 greats of turns, and would not, until death relaxed the sphincter that kept her little piece of homeland and kin within her. Swiftkiller continued her search. 2 of her troopers and 6 barbarians. A poor trade. And it was her fault for not having trained her troopers against the rolling garbage attack. It was an old and seldom used tactic, but in this time and in this environment, it had come close to equaling the odds for the barbarians. Needing a recalcitrant pouch on one of the last barbarian skin sacks, she almost cut her tread. Moving off and sliding a pseudopod under the edge of that folded skin, she extracted a short sword. The fact that a barbarian had succeeded in wresting a short sword from a trooper was not unusual, but the condition of the short sword was. She examined its shining sides and keenly honed edge with wonder. If only her troopers could be encouraged to keep their weapons in such good condition. She pouched the shining sword in her weapons pouch and finished the inspection, then finally turned to cleaning herself. The troop was still on full circle march alert when she finally finished and resumed command.
"Rest!"
rolled the command through the crust, and the gleaming needles of the dragon teeth stopped in space, paused, then relaxed into a disarrayed but still outward-facing circle.
"Make camp! Post guards! Squad leaders, report!"
The commands rippled out through the crust, and the troop camp took on its normal lifestyle as the subordinates interpreted the commander's orders, added a few of their own for local order and discipline, and then gathered near the mound of cooling bodies for a conference with their troop commander.
"We are in no real hurry," Swiftkiller announced to them, "and we have a long way to go in hostile territory without food storage depots. We will stop here long enough to dry the meat. Then we will move on to the east."
The squad leaders were pleased with the commander's decision. The troopers had been on constant march for 12 turns, and this break would not only give the more restless ones a few moments to relieve the pressure of their juices, but would also give the whole command a chance to revert to a semi-normal lifestyle, not to mention a welcome change in diet from the ever-present food pods. The squad leaders had no trouble in getting volunteers for butcher duty, and soon the whole pile of 8 bodies was neatly drained, the muscular meat carefully sliced from the skin, and the leathery skin stretched out as far as it would go in the easy direction. The ends were held down with the ample weight of a couple of otherwise useless novice astrologers, and left to dry for a turn on the glowing crust, until they were ready to rewrap the meat hunks that they had so recently enveloped. When the butchering crew came to the eggs, there was a lengthy pause. One of the troopers and the trooper killer barbarian were found to have eggs in their egg cases. Unfortunately for the sensibilities of the butchering crew, the precious egglings were still alive in their leathery sacks. The news of the living egglings brought Swiftkiller to the scene at once. As much as she hated it, it was her duty to pass judgment. She looked carefully at the leathery egg sacks, sliding each one in turn under the protection of a hatching mantle, to feel the pulsating life form within. Unfortunately, the pulsations from the wee ones only confirmed what they all knew. Egg sacs with that color had no chance of surviving without many more turns of protection and nourishment within their mother. Swiftkiller felt the terrible urge to lift the little eggling into her egg case, to give it the protection and nourishment that it needed. But she knew full well that within one turn, her normally protective egg case would have swollen into a bloated anger, and the vile juices that it would have exuded would have literally dissolved the egg sac and its precious cargo. As much as they all would have liked to have saved them, the egglings were doomed. Swiftkiller softly took the two quivering egg sacs into a holding pouch and moved off. The butchering crew continued their work, while the rest of the expedition followed Swiftkiller to the other side of the camp.
"Another nasty duty," Swiftkiller complained.
She drew out the flashing sword that she had so recently acquired.
"If it has to be done, let it be done quickly," she said.
With two swift slices, she sacrificed the juices of the egglings to the all-absorbing crust of egg, which glowed momentarily in response. The others returned to the camp, but Swiftkiller, who had had the duty, stayed on to punish herself. As she looked at the dead egglings, she was horrified at her inner thoughts.
"That is a tender-looking slice of meat," her appetite said. "Not even a barbarian would eat an eggling," she remonstrated.
Shifting her attention from the immature egglings baking on the glowing crust, she flowed back into the camp to supervise the wrapping of the meat, for that would be the troop's main source of food for many turns to come. Time, 7:56 and 36 seconds, GMT. Monday, 20 June, 2050. After 24 turns, the expedition began to approach the East Pole. Every direction was now a hard direction for travel. And if it weren't for the disciplined nature of the troopers, who were used to marching in close formation, the going would have been difficult. Fortunately, since there was no easy direction of travel, there was also no danger of rapid attack, and their guard could be relaxed. Swiftkiller changed the usual loose marching circle into a modified wedge. The troopers were placed in a sharp-pointed chevron formation, with the front of the chevron thrusting steadily through the resistant atmosphere to force an opening. The remainder of the troopers kept the gap open, and the small group of scientist astrologers moved swiftly along at the trailing edge, moving easily into the gap created by the troopers. To break the monotony, the squads in the troop had been having a contest. Each squad would take a turn as pathbreaker and see how many treads they could keep up the pace before having to fall back and let the following squad have their turn. Each squad, of course, had to break the previous squad's record, and when Swiftkiller began to notice that several troopers on the front line were beginning to surreptitiously drop equipment and food parcels from their pouches in order to keep up the pace, she decided to call a break before things got beyond control.
"Cease march!"
Swiftkiller's voice rolled through the crust. An exhausted group of troopers halted their steady push and felt the hardness close in around them. Since all directions were hard going, no one wanted to move from his position, but Swiftkiller was pleased to see that the squad leaders kept after their troopers until they were dispersed in a rough circle, with a few individuals designated to keep one or two eyes on the horizon while they were eating.
"They really must be tired," Swiftkiller thought as she looked around. "No one has the energy to pair off for a little fun."
Having stayed at her normal position near the center of the troop, Swiftkiller had not had to participate in the exhausting procedure of breaking path, and so had not even begun to tax her great strength. So she was feeling fine, and would have liked to have a little relaxation after eating. But a quick survey of her many lovers among the troop convinced her that she should let them rest. Swiftkiller wandered over to the clump of astrologers and approached Cliffwatcher, who was busy tying knots in a tally string. On the crust beside him were three tread sticks.
"Amazing, simply amazing,"
Cliffwatcher was murmuring to himself as he added knot after knot to the tally string.
"What's amazing?"
Swiftkiller asked, curious as always, and confident enough in her position to ask questions of someone many turns her junior.
"Egg is really shaped like an egg," exclaimed Cliffwatcher,
as a few of his eyes glanced away from the tally string and noticed her approach. He then saw the bewilderment and the jerky overtones of Swiftkiller's normal eye-wave pattern, and continued.
"I have been keeping account of the number of standard treads on our march with the treadsticks. The East Pole is on a very flat place on Egg. It takes many, many treads of travel before there is a noticeable change in the horizon," he said.
Swiftkiller looked ahead along their direction of travel. She could see the East Pole Mountains just raising their tops over the horizon. It was true. The horizon had hardly changed for the last three turns.
"Like an egg?"
she asked.
"Yes," the young astrologer said. "An egg sac is flattened on the top and bottom because of the pull of gravity, and spreads out in the other directions. Our home, Egg, seems to be constructed the same way. Near the east and west poles, it is very flat, and you have to go a long way to see a change in the horizon. Halfway between the east and west pole, where Bright's heaven is, the horizon is very close in the east and west directions, but many treads away in the hard direction."
Swiftkiller knew this elementary fact of the topography near Bright's heaven, but she had never connected it with the shape of Egg. However, neither she nor Cliffwatcher realized that Cliffwatcher's calculations had misled him. The star was spherical, not egg-shaped. It was his tread sticks that were distorted, giving him a false impression. Everything on the star, the tread sticks, the dragon crystal weapons, and even the nuclei in their bodies, was distorted by the trillion Gauss magnetic field of the star, so that they were many times longer along the magnetic field lines than across them. Since even their eyes participated in the general stretching, they couldn't see the distortion. Everything looked normal to them. Swiftkiller turned professional.
"How many treads until we reach the East Pole Mountains?" she asked.
Cliffwatcher, who was proud of his advanced education in conceptual geometry, immediately went into a calculation trance, his practiced counting tendrils shooting forth from his body. The tendrils began to wave and interlace with each other at blinding speed. Finally, he broke from the trance.
2 dozen standard marches," he announced.
Swiftkiller looked at the East Pole Mountains that loomed over the deceptively near horizon and announced,
"Then I guess we had better get the troop moving."
Without shifting, she roared,
"At alert!"
The troop smoothly reformed and continued their push to the east, the disruptive contest between squads forgotten. Cliffwatcher had been right. It really was about 2 dozen standard marches to the East Pole Mountains. But since a standard march between breaks was impossible in this terrain, it really took much longer.
"It is like constantly climbing a hill in the hard direction,"
Swiftkiller complained to herself as she took a turn at the point of the chevron, forcing its way into the hard direction.
"I know," said the trooper at her right, "except you never end up on top."
Swiftkiller breasted another furry hillock in front of her. Each tiny little thread of crust was sticking up toward the sky in the easy direction. It looked impossible. The thread seemed to be laughing at the powerful gravity pull of Egg. But when Swiftkiller had to push over that tiny little thread, along with a myriad others that made up the fuzzy surface, she found that they were powerfully strong. It took a great deal of strength just to move through the fuzz, knocking it down and pushing on over it. Then, on top of it all, if the fuzz slowed her down too much, the hard direction closed in on her and made the going even worse. The troop finally reached the foothills of the East Pole Mountains without further incident. Swiftkiller looked with awe at the height of the mountains, then upwards at the eyes of Bright still hanging in the sky far above the mountains, defying the mighty pull of Egg. Swiftkiller put the camp on bivouac status. First, long-range sentries were put out at a good distance from the camp. Then she allowed the troopers to put down their weapons. A file of troopers went into a virgin stand of crust fuzz and stamped out a circular depressed region where the dragon teeth and the short swords were stacked to block out the constant winds. In the center, the remainder of the pods and dried meat was stored, while those who had been burdened with their weight during the long march became free again to frolic without care. Hunting parties were formed, with old and new couples taking off in small, carefree groups to see what was off on the horizon. Now was an important time for Swiftkiller. She gathered the astrologers and began to set up her experiment. She first took the flat glancer mirror and set it on a mound of rubble at an angle until she could go off at a distance and see the eyes of Bright reflected off the center of the mirror.
"The eyes of Bright are larger and closer, and they look a little brighter," Cliffwatcher remarked, as a few of his eyes scanned the cluster of seven lights in the sky.
"I should hope so, after all the work we did to get here," Swiftkiller said crankily, as she struggled to scrape a notch for the curved expander in the fuzzy crust some distance away from the glancer.
"I could never figure out why Bright chose to send his eyes to the East Pole when we were in Bright's heaven," Cliffwatcher mused.
"Perhaps Bright did not want to see us too well, because we are so wicked," Swiftkiller said in annoyance. "Here, hold this while I sight through the pointing hole."
Swiftkiller had the large, curved expander standing vertically on the crust. It came up almost to the top of Cliffwatcher as he moved over to surround it and hold it vertical. He was glad it had not been his job to keep that thing pouched during their travels. Cliffwatcher flowed his body away from the center of the expander as Swiftkiller backed off and stared through the small hole in the plate. Swiftkiller moved her eye until she could see the center of the glancer through the hole. There, shining in the center of the flat mirror, were the eyes of Bright. Now she had to tilt the expander until the image of her eye off the flat backside of the expander was swallowed up in the hole that she was looking through. In that way, she knew that the expander was pointing at the glancer, which in turn was pointing up at the eyes of Bright.
"Up a little," she said. "Hold it."
She moved quickly, and soon Cliffwatcher's place was taken by a cluster of pieces of crust. The message to the strange, stick-like beings in the inner eye had been decided long ago. Since they had used a rectangular format with a prime number of rows and columns to send crude pictures, they would certainly recognize that format if it were beamed back to them. Only the picture inside the rectangle would be new. First, it would show a picture of the eyes of Bright over the East Pole, with a dragon tooth pointing the way to Bright's heaven. Then, later pictures would show the eyes of Bright hovering over Bright's heaven, with the distinctive profile of the East Pole Mountains poking up over the horizon of Egg. Each picture had been converted into a complex tally string, ready to read off. Swiftkiller gathered her crew of astrologers, and they proceeded to retransmit the message that they had sent in vain from the compound back at the Inner Eye Institute.
Long burn. Flick, 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 dash, flick,
Swiftkiller intoned as she ran the tally string through a set of tendrils. The crew of flare holders and pod juice controllers kept up their steady work, and flash after flash of light glared from the end of the flare, reflected from the curved surface of the expander into a straight beam that flashed across the crust to the glancer, then went beaming upwards toward the cluster of lights in the sky. After several lines, Swiftkiller would take another look through the sighting holes to make sure that the beam was being sent off in the right direction, while the flare crew replaced their flares with fresh ones. After the first picture had been sent, Swiftkiller went over to the astrologer whom she had put in charge of the dark detector. She was slightly disappointed that there had been no darkening of the detector, but she resolved to keep on with the rest of the series. A dozen turns, and more than twice as many messages later, Swiftkiller finally had to admit that perhaps the messages were still not getting through.
"The eyes still look dim to us, so you can imagine that our weak little light is going to be very dim by the time it gets up through this murky atmosphere,"
Cliff Watcher said, as his thinned-out body tried to knead the worries out of the flattened Swiftkiller. Swiftkiller lay relaxed under the tender ministrations of Cliff Watcher and felt the small globules that used to be a piece of Cliff Watcher moving slowly through her body on their way to her egg case. Her body was at rest, but her mind was a turmoil of emotion.
"If they cannot see us yet, then we must get closer," she said. "I am going to climb the mountains to where the atmosphere is clearer."
Cliff Watcher's kneading stopped.
"But that will take forever," he remonstrated.
"So it may," said Swiftkiller,
who had slipped out from under Cliff Watcher and had rapidly resumed her more normal shape. She was now putting on her office of command as she gathered and pouched the tools, weapons, and trinkets that she had cast aside earlier.
"But we are going anyway."
Time, 7:56 and 48 seconds, GMT. Monday, 20 June, 2050. The climbing of the East Pole Mountains was like a siege. The mountains were many times higher than any that had ever been attempted. Swiftkiller took her time to organize her support. For once she had started up the mountain, the organization would have to run itself. The formal command structure of the troop was dismantled, and a new arrangement organized, more along the lines of a permanent border fort, replaced it. A quarry crew was sent out, and soon a fortified compound replaced the campground. Regular hunting parties were organized, and the short swords and dragon teeth soon were sinking their sharp fangs into wandering animals instead of their natural prey. With much grumbling, long rows of petal plants were placed in the crust,